RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
This is CX of M Radio, the voice of customer experience professionals.
Welcome to another World of UX podcast. This is your host, Darren Hood. Thanks, everybody, for taking the time to join us on today. And as always, a special welcome to those of you that are joining us and listening for the very first time. Well, after that long series, my longest series on EQ, as is my custom, we had a little bit of segue right after that. And I told you, and I've been talking about how important I feel it is to use my venue to help other voices get out here. Not necessarily voices that nobody hears, but just voices, period. Somebody's other than mine, for God's sake. A lot of other people have great things to say, and I want to bring those people to you as often as I can. So I want to go on a little run here in sharing and bringing some people in the UX community to the show so folks around the world are able to hear them, and then you can sharpen your saw with the things that they are sharing. So this week, I have with me one of my former professors when I was at Kent State University, someone who I treasure immensely, someone who had a big impact on my life. He never heard me say this, so I can give him his flowers now, but he had a tremendous impact on my life and continues to, because we have a relationship, we engage, we interact from time to time, and I just always get great downloads. I always leave invigorated. So without further ado, let me bring to you Ben Woods. And as always is the case on this show, I let people introduce themselves. I will let him tell you about him. And as Debbie Levitt always says, let the world know why we should care. Take it away, Ben.
Great. Well, thanks for having me, Darren. I'm not sure I can follow that introduction. So that's it. That's a wrap. Thank you.
No.
thank you. That's very, very kind words. I really appreciate it. Let me tell you a little bit about myself. I'm Ben Woods. I'm a user experience consultant, and I'm the owner of a company called Covalent Studio. We specialize in research, design, digital transformation, consulting, and also offshore software development. Worked with lots of startups, as well as very large companies like Dell, Pfizer, et cetera. Mm. I've actually been working in the digital space since 99, and I would say maybe a bona fide UX practitioner since we'll say 06, 07-ish thereabouts. But I think the as Debbie says, who am I and why should you listen to me? I'm not sure why anybody should listen to me, but I will tell you that my experience is very broad. I've worked with lots of industries. I've changed my career many times, starting as a graphic designer, going into UX, going into higher education, and now doing what I'm doing now. So that's who I am.
That is fantastic. Fantastic. I remember there was a book, right? You had a book that you did once. I vaguely remember that.
I wrote the introduction for Mark Majors' book. There is a book that actually, I did not write it, but I do have a credit on it. I was the designer for a book way back when.
Okay.
So yes,
okay.
If you do a search on Amazon for D. Ben Woods, I believe I may have one or two book credits, Mark's okay. book, as well as another book on, it was called Corporate Lunacy. It was a self-published book
by okay.
a retired executive from Akron.
Okay. Okay, great. I remember there was a book somewhere, so I wanted to make sure that folks...
There's a book somewhere in me, but I haven't written it yet.
I want to make sure people know about that, so go in and dig into it, because you do have a lot of fantastic things to say. We have this standard script that we follow, something that we always leave, but it is a baseline for us, so I'm going to jump in to some of these. You talked about a couple things already, but... how did you actually get into UX? You mentioned you were a graphic designer. How did you actually get into UX? What was that light bulb moment for you, and where did your shift come from?
Well, I mean, I would say really the story about how I got here and how I got into UX is really the story about how fortunate I've been to have some really great teachers in my life from my youth up to even today. Who really encouraged my explorations and really ultimately gave me good advice. And that's really, I think, a lot of what drives me is having the opportunity to help people in their journeys. So I was interested in technology, science, and art really from a very early age, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, all the way back in seventh grade, I was given extra time at lunch to work in the computer lab and try to design a video game, which... I mean, I guess that would have probably been in the late 80s. And, you know, you can imagine the discipline that a seventh grader has in developing a video game. It did not last long, but I was given the opportunity. You know, and then in high school, I developed, I actually programmed an application for the old, I guess they still make them, the TI-82 calculators.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I wrote an open source program that spread throughout the school like wildfire. I believe we called it beta, and it was basically a way for students to quickly calculate and accurately calculate various chemistry formulas. Now, wow. What's really interesting about that was, you know, I was in Algebra 2. We were required to use these graphing calculators. I was in chemistry. I had a hard time with the formulas, and I realized, you know what, I could program this calculator to do the work for me. Like, I understood conceptually how the formulas worked, mm-hmm. but when it came down to, you know, pencil and paper, it was hard for me to do. So I said, you know what, I'm going to use this technology to make me a better student and build this program. Now, what's funny about that experience is some people said, well, that's cheating. And I was kind of like, well, is it? So ultimately, I took it to the teacher and I said, hey, I built this. Can I use it? And to his credit, he said, well, if you know enough to program this, then you understand the concepts. So yeah. Yes, you can use it. And then of course, like I said, from there it spread throughout the school. So, wow. You know, I've always really been interested in technology and how it helps people and such. And so, you know, getting back to how I got here, you know, one of the things I tried to sort out when I was in high school, was what career could sustain, my appetite for creativity, mm-hmm. Technology, and really just keep me engaged. I love learning. I'm a curious person. I'd always done really well in school. And so I really had a hard time figuring out what I wanted to do. And by the way, I think it's crazy, even today, that we expect 17-year-olds to figure out what they're going to do for the rest of their lives.
Right.
So, and that's part of the reason why my career has changed so much, is because people change. But,
yes.
You know, I really could have gone into anything. Initially, I thought about going into engineering. I gave serious thought into civil engineering, mechanical engineering, or possibly materials engineering. But, you know, again, gets back to the idea of having really great teachers throughout my life who've taken, you know, an interest and encouraged me. I had a fantastic art teacher, Larry Spurgeon, when I was a student, and he introduced me to graphic design. And so after studying with him in high school, I decided to pursue my BFA at the Visual Communication Design Program at Kent State. Mm-hmm. And it was great. And, you know, it was very, I was there at a pivotal time in the late 90s. And again, I had another great teacher, professor named Jerry Kaulbach, who at the time, that's a whole story. He encouraged me in his way to pursue web design. And so I was very fortunate within our cohort of students to have been exposed really early on to web. Again, this was like 97, 98. Mm-hmm. And so that really kind of was the springboard that got me into digital design and web design. And that's really when it kind of clicked for me. It was like, this is what I was supposed to do. It's creative. It's technical. It keeps both sides of my brain firing. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where it went. So started working professionally in 99 and really in the graphic design field. Worked for a couple of ad agencies and design firms. And I would say right around 2003, 2004, I realized, and this is sad, it was only like 3-4 years after graduation, I realized the graphic design industry that I loved was changing and not for the better. There was so much disruption from DIY, you know, the graphic design industry was becoming less professional, less qualified. At the same time, it was the kind of thing where anybody, you know, with a couple $1,000s could get a Mac and some Adobe software and call themselves a graphic designer, degree, training or not. And the other thing too is for a number of companies, that's good enough. And so I kind of, so I was really
sound very familiar.
we're going to come back to this. We're going to come back to this topic. So I realized that, the environments I was working in, small design firms and agencies, those were hurting. The billables were low. They were not making the money they could make. And by the way, they couldn't pay the salary that, you know, was a good competitive salary. And so, I changed. I went to a multinational manufacturing firm, Eaton Corporation, worked there. And really, that's when things really changed. And I'd say my career has been a story of change. So went there, had an opportunity to pursue my graduate degree. It's great whenever you have an employer who will pay for your degrees. And they did. Yeah. So I was very fortunate to have that. And I was trying to figure out, what should I pursue? Should I get an MBA or should I do something else? And ultimately what I decided to do was pursue the Master of Science program at Kent State. We called it Information Architecture Knowledge Management at the time.
Right, it's
UX, it's the same courses. And then what I decided was that was a better complement to my undergraduate degree than the MBA. Because I said, you know what, I need something that is a contrast to my undergrad. I don't want to be a designer with an MBA. Of course, then a couple years later, I ended up getting an MBA too. So so that's really, I would say, kind of how I got here is, it was just through iteration and learning and seeing opportunities and really being very fortunate to have the ability to take advantage of those opportunities.
That is fantastic. I think a lot of people need to hear that too. Because I hear a lot of people, I think they put too much pressure on themselves trying to figure out what to do instead of taking a step back. And sometimes it'll come to you in a sense, things you sort of whittle it out as you go, but it's not always clear. The direction is not always very clear. And it sounds to me also like your story is similar to a lot of other people where you sort of happen into UX. In a sense, would you say it's, I mean, today people can say, I want to go into UX. Back then you didn't. It's just, things just sort of happen and the dominoes fall in such a way. And the next thing you know, you're looking up and you're doing this stuff. It's sort of interesting.
100%.
Yeah. So from an Acumen standpoint, though, and I'm going right down the standard, people have heard these before, how did you develop what you feel is your current level of expertise? There's always a story associated with how did we, you know, we ended up here, but how did you actually get good at it? What were the things that happened that sort of triggered the direction, or maybe some certain experiences on certain projects that caused you, you said you're curious. And I know I call that, I actually, in my model of EQ, I factor curiosity into it. And I think that that's a major factor. If somebody's going to excel at this discipline, curiosity is a big part. So what was it that happened for Ben that helped to build that, the, all that, that skill set that helped you to be confident and very steadfast, so to speak?
I'd say that it really comes down to, again, curiosity. So, I mean, just as I was really interested in painting when I was younger, and engineering and drawing and such, just the willingness to learn new things. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a period, a few years back, I was doing a lot of hacking with Arduino and a little bit with Raspberry Pi. And just as recently as a couple weeks ago, I was actually playing around with some eye tracking equipment and hacking it to see if there are ways that we could use it to manipulate information. And so, you know, it comes down to just trying new things, iterating on what you're learning. Mm-hmm. And that's really, I think, how I've kind of developed this. You know, I would say the challenge or the counter to that is, and I've gotten this feedback from people before, is we can't figure out exactly what box to put you in, you know, like, and I literally had it was a mentoring meeting years ago with the chief marketing officer at Eaton Corporation when I was there. And we were talking, he said, well, what to do with Ben? Cause you don't really fit in our standard roles. I was like, well, you know, now 10 years ago, that probably was more of a problem. I think more companies now are much more accepting of different types of experience. Mm-hmm. And they realize that having different experiences are complementary to each other. Yes. I think, you know, a lot of, you know, old school companies, they kind of say, well, you have to have done the job for 20 years before we can give you the job. And and that just doesn't work. So,
yeah.
So again, I think it's just, you know, learning different things, things that are not directly in front of you, but trying different things.
Yep. Fantastic. In all of these travels and everything that you've done and bouncing around to doing different, get engaging, I should say, in different types of activities, when especially when it comes to UX, because there are several places where people can land. At one time, we used to do everything. Nowadays, a lot of people are specialists. What's your fondest memory? That thing that when you think about UX, that the big warm fuzzies that you get when you have this, you think back on a project or could it be something groundbreaking that caused a paradigm shift with you? What's your fondest memory as a UX professional?
I mean, it's tough to pick one because I've had so many.
I'll take more.
I've been very fortunate, I think, to get into this profession. It's really allowed me to see the world and learn about industries that I may never have thought to learn about. I mean, as a result of user experience, I've learned a lot about financial services. I've learned a lot about medicine. I'm not a doctor, obviously, but a lot about medical services, healthcare delivery, manufacturing, and even the startup community. So, I mean, I've learned a lot about different industries. I've also been able to visit places in the world that I, you know, if you had talked to the 17-year-old version of me who grew up in Canton, Ohio, and said, hey, you know, you're going to end up having chances to visit, you know, Eastern Europe, India, Puerto Rico, blah, 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 and such, I'd say, yeah, you're kidding. I'm never going to do that. I mean, you're talking to a guy who took his first airplane trip when he was 23 to go to his, after he got married for our honeymoon. So that was the first time I actually got onto an airliner. And now decades later, I'm not even sure how many times I've been on a plane. It's, you know, I mean, you know, I think at a certain point, that's just kind of what happened. So, I mean, yeah. I've been very fortunate to have those opportunities and meet different people and encounter different cultures. So, you know, and that's, I love it. But I mean, the other really great thing is it's especially rewarding to see former students and colleagues do really well. You're one you mentioned that you were a past student of mine, and great to see you doing well. I love, you know, having colleagues who, you know, obviously students who are, you know, in executive positions with great companies. It's great to see that they're doing well. Felicia McDonald is another example. We talked about before, and she, you know, she's, you know, she actually had her first UX role with me at Eaton. And we brought her on as a contractor. We were not able to hold on to her for very long because she got another job. but she's doing great. Now she's managing a team of designers at Sherwin-Williams. Mm-hmm. And she's, I would say she's really growing into a leader in the field.
Yes.
So that's you know, it just makes me so happy to see people doing well. And it is a little, not a little, but it's fulfilling to think that I may have had a little part of that. Maybe I gave a little nudge.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. So. That's great stuff. That's great stuff. What is the best decision you've ever made that comes to mind as a UX professional?
You know, I mean, honestly, going into UX was the best decision for me. I mean, it really was. I mean, everything since then, it's been great. So yeah, I mean, everything goes back to going into UX I can't be happier with the decision to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Likewise. I can think of a bunch of different things in my life, but yeah, it was a good decision because I was about to go the direction of instructional design. I was about to go and get a master's in education from Boise State.
Okay.
And I tried to get an information architecture gig, didn't get it. And it floored me. And I wondered, what could I do better? Because I really love this. And I took two steps back. Let me go and look back and see what I really want to do here. And when I assessed everything, I had already been doing freelance web design in the evenings. And I reassessed everything and I said, you know what? I really enjoy this information architecture work. That's all I saw it as at the time in the interaction design where I love this. You know what? See you, Boise State. I'm out. I have no idea what awaits me, but I'm going in this direction. I felt like somebody walking into a Stargate or something, a sci-fi reference out there. So yeah, it was a good decision. Biggest regret.
Oh, biggest regret. You know, regret's kind of a funny word. I'm not sure that I would say I have a whole lot of regrets. Mm-hmm. I think that there are certainly things that I could have done better. I've certainly made mistakes, you know, along the way. I'm not going to tell you what they were. I kind of like to maintain the illusion that I'm perfect, but
it's actually fair. It's fair.
No, really. I would say things I could have done better. I would say probably early on in my career, I probably lacked a lot of emotional intelligence. I was probably a bit overconfident. I think that comes with being, you know, in your early 20s, working for one of the top design firms in town. So I was probably a bit cocky, a bit off-putting, maybe even, and also probably a bit judgmental. And that's unfortunate because whenever you behave that way, it does make it hard to have good relations with people. It makes it hard to make friends. It makes, you know, makes it hard to relate with people. And so I think that's probably the one thing I would say is early on in my career and in my life, really, I kind of probably should have been a little bit more intentional about being friendlier and nice to people. You know, I mean, and that's hard to say, but I mean, I do think it's true. I think it's just generally, it's important to, you know, treat people well, treat people with respect, be humble. you know, you don't need to tell people how great you are.
right.
You know? So, I mean, I think that's probably my biggest regrets is it's just, you know, low emotional intelligence quotient early on.
I think that one's common too. I think everybody early in their career felt sure. the same way. Yeah. Biggest challenge.
I think the biggest challenge from a UX perspective has been and continues to be, honestly, we spend an inordinate amount of time communicating the value of UX, even to this day. I actually just gave a presentation on communicating the value of UX a couple of days ago. And it is funny. It's kind of like, I mean, we're having the same discussions.
Yeah.
I'm having the same discussions back in November that I had 10 years ago. Where we're talking about, okay, well, this is why we're doing things. And this is what the effects are. You know, it's tough because it's like, I would rather spend much more of my time doing the work and managing the work and getting results than, you know, putting together PowerPoint presentations, you know, citing McKinsey and Boston Group and DMI and talking about, you know, $1 invested in UX yields $100 and such. And,
yeah.
And then trying to relate it specifically to a business outcome, for example, you know, like, well, you know, if we make this improvement, then it's going to yield X millions of dollars of additional revenue. And we can project that. So, I mean, I do think that is, one of the challenges, that I continue to face. And I think a lot of UX practitioners face if they're at the level where they are presenting recommendations and findings and really trying to influence business outcomes. I think that continues to happen. And, you know, because there's a lot of people who really are just kind of stuck in their roles with their blinders on. Right.
Yep.
So I mean, if they're in finance, they know finance and they, if they know engineering, they know engineering and they don't necessarily think about UX and design and such. So that's the big challenge.
Yep, that's a good point. And yeah, I think some people are going to resonate with a lot of folks when they hear that. This is the part of the segment where I think this is where we tend to like really spread our wings and go all over the place with the next question. And I think this is going to go back to a couple of notes we had earlier, something mm-hmm, we talked mm-hmm. about before we began recording. What observations about the discipline today stand out to you? That's wow. That's a big net.
Yeah, we're really getting the meat and potatoes here, aren't we? This is how much time do you have?
Go for it.
So I might say some things, Yeah, I actually got a really similar question on a panel a couple of days ago, and I told them, I said, I have a number of concerns. I'm going to limit them to two since there are other people here. I'm concerned about a number of things with the UX profession as it is today and as we look to the future. And I will say, although I have concerns, it's a mixed bag. I mean, the number one thing is dilution. I think there are too many dilution and confusion in the marketplace. We are seeing people are talking about design thinking and, you know, and they're confusing design thinking with user experience and such. And then we have different frameworks that people are working with. And so I'm seeing a lot of people who are talking about design thinking and they're not thinking about UX. And I mean, there's a firm in Northeast Ohio, I won't get more specific than that, who has a UX team, and they also have design thinkers on that team. And I'm kind of sitting there scratching my head, like, well, so what the design thinking leads are supposed to tell the UX practitioners how to do their job? That doesn't make sense, because design thinkers, at least in this area, aren't doing research. They're just running workshops. They're just running workshops. They're just talking about thinking. Imagine you're the user. No, go talk to a user. Go watch them. You know, a lot of the UX problems we have today are because people don't do a very good job of imagining they're the user.
Yep.
So why would we continue to perpetuate this? Now, I'm not saying that design thinking is 100% bad. I think that a lot of applications of it are bad because people don't know how to do it appropriately. So design thinking is a big one. You know, incidentally, that company that I mentioned, I mean, gosh, they have a turnover rate. I mean, I think the average tenure for that team is like 18 months. I mean, they are just cycling through talent. It's crazy. So, and I would say it's because they don't know what they're doing at a leadership level. They don't know, are they a design thinking shop? Are they a UX shop? What are they doing? It's funny. I talked with one of their executives when I was working with them a couple of years ago. They said, we just don't do digital well. It's like, well, okay. I mean, it's a good first step. So, you know, what are we going to do about that? I mean, do we just say, okay, hope Google buys us? I don't know. it was just shocking. It was like so disheartening. Like this company, like they said, we just don't do digital well. And it's like, well, I mean, I'm not a very tall guy. I mean, you know, that's like me saying, well, I'm just never going to have a very good vertical jump. Well, I'm 5'8", so that's true, but there are other things that I can affect. So, right. Design thinking, malaise in some organizations. The other thing I would mention is Scrum, at Agile. And, you know, years ago, we started talking about Agile and Scrum, and I think there was a lot of benefit and a lot of validity to it. And I still think there is, by the way. But I think, and one of the things about Agile design methods and Scrum is the acceptance of iteration and change as you move through a project. Mm-hmm. That's great. Because if you're going with waterfall methods, it's very restrictive in terms of how you can actually deliver the end result. I remember when I was at a company, they had their corporate product or a project management system. I'm trying to say it without saying their name. So that's why I'm stumbling over my words. But they had their corporate method for managing products, and it was our projects, and it was all waterfall based. And it was actually kind of dumb, because it's like, well, okay, this makes sense if you're trying to design a transmission to go into a truck. Like, I know what the end result is going to be of putting together that transition. I know what the result, if I apply it to IT, I know what the result is of moving from one version of an email server to another. I get that. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the next version of the company's flagship website is going to be at the beginning of the project, because we have to go through the research. We have to go through iteration. We have to actually do the work of finding our way to figure out what that is. Yep. And so when we started to encounter Agile and Scrum, it was kind of like, that's great. We should adopt that. My concern with Agile and Scrum as it's being applied today, however, is less of an acceptance of iteration and more of a focus on, okay, we got to get through these stories. We got to get through the stories in the next, you know, in the 2-week sprint. And we're doing less learning and we're doing less documentation. We're doing less understanding of what we are at. What is the actual problem we're trying to solve? Yep. And what I'm seeing more and more is this is relegating UX practitioners from being strategic partners and giving insights, and more reducing them to basically being a technician who is applying a design system to an interface. You know, so more and more, it's kind of like, well, we don't like that color. Well, okay, well, I guess I'll have to go back to the design system and see what it says. And so that's my concern with how a number of companies are using Scrum and Agile today. Is it's not about iteration. It's about just getting through that backlog. And, you know, really, I want more people to step back and say, should we even have this backlog?
Right.
You know, like, what are we doing here? We don't exist just to get on a treadmill and crank out mock-ups.
Yeah, I call that UX hamster work now.
Exactly. And then, you know, I guess the other big big thing that concerns me, and this is a big one in the UX profession. It's what I call the lemon problem. Are you familiar with the lemon problem?
No.
So the lemon problem. Okay. So the lemon problem is, it's actually, I believe it was a paper that was written some time ago. It's from economics. And really what it refers to is what we call information asymmetry in a market, which ultimately leads to a failure of a market. And the example that was given is the used car market. Yeah. So there is a information asymmetry in that market. The dealer knows how good a used car is, right? They know if it's garbage, but they know what's wrong with it. They either fixed it or they didn't fix it, and they put a sticker on it. Buyers, when they go to a used car lot, they don't know what the dealer knows, mm-hmm. and so as a result, they discount the price of that vehicle. Dealer says it's worth $5,000. The customer says, okay, you're asking $5,000, but I don't know, you know, what kind of crap is going on with this thing. I'll give you $3,000. And so that is the lemon problem, because people are trying to avoid lemons. And so as a result, this leads to market failures where, you know, prices are not as high as producers want them to be, and they aren't as low as customers want them to be. And I see the same thing happening in the UX industry, right? There is a demand for talent. Mm-hmm. There is, and there is no shortage of people who will call themselves a UX practitioner. There is no shortage of workshops, boot camps, private colleges. There's no shortage of places who will give you a certificate that says, okay, you did your 4-week boot camp, go out and make six figures. you know, there is no shortage of influencers. And you can find them, influencers on YouTube who will make a video saying, I just got a six-figure job as a UX practitioner, yep. and I don't even have a degree. Yep. And it's kind of like, okay, well, are you really a UX professional? Really? and so what's I think is happening is there's such a demand for UX talent, and so many people are rushing in because they see UX and they think it's easy. Yep. It's easy to do this and you can make lots of money. And so what we have is a lot of people who don't know what they're doing flooding the market. On the other side is employers. A lot of companies don't really know what they're hiring for. Mm-hmm. You can see it in job descriptions, right? When they're asking for somebody to have like a beautiful portfolio, it's like, well, this is a UX role, not an art director role.
Yes, so, yes, yes. Let's get some applause.
Yeah. And so, and also the unicorn phenomena. So we have bad job descriptions. We have bad talent. And so my concern is that ultimately we're going to end up seeing substitution or lower salaries for UX practitioners. And I mean, if you can look, I mean, there are companies who are working on artificial intelligence to replace designers. Now, will they ever replace all designers? I don't think so, because artificial intelligence is based on rules and past performance and trying to project into the future. And, mm-hmm. and the truth is people are irrational and hard to predict. And so that's where I think UX practitioners as humans have an edge.
Yep.
But yeah, I'm very concerned about the job market for UX going forward.
And saying that, you make me think about your earlier comment about when you were talking about what happened with graphic design. And I think that's a good segue there.
Yeah, well, and I would say that you see it in a lot of things too. It's not just bad jobs and unqualified talent. You know, I mentioned, you know, just a few minutes ago, the organization that is just cycling through talent. I mean, you know, 15 years ago, there were a handful of UX jobs in Cleveland. Now, just this one company, they must have 30 UX practitioners. And so there's such demand and so many people who will go in and again, just cycle through these jobs. I think that we need certification. I think ultimately we need what I would call, it's not my term. I think it's actually borrowed from maybe dietitians or other areas. I think we need certification or permissive licensure by third parties. You know, I mean, it's not good enough in my mind to have a Nielsen Norman Group certification or an HFI certification. You know, that's self-certification. I mean, I can make a sticker that says Ben Wood certified and give it to you if you pay me a couple $100. But unless it's accredited by a third party, it's meaningless.
Right.
And so I believe we need certification. I mean, I gave a talk on about this a couple of years ago at UXPA and for World Usability Day. And, you know, there are so many industries that have some degree of certification and licensure, and we don't. And I don't understand why we refuse to do this. I mean, if you want to braid hair in the state of Ohio, you need to have a license. I mean,
yeah,
I believe it's actually a health code violation if you don't. But I mean, there's also other certifications. I actually spoke when I was doing my research on this. I spoke with a woman who she works in the parking industry. There are certified parking professionals. Parking professionals.
Now that's a shock.
now when she explained it, it made sense because it's not just, you know, taking money and giving tickets. It's also about doing the planning and logistics. Mm-hmm. And there is, I get that.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But still you see, cake decorators. They're certified cake decorators, but we don't have a certification for UX practitioners. I mean, it's crazy. And so it kind of concerns me. And again, I'm seeing echoes of what happened in the graphic design industry 20 years ago, where there's no certification, there are no standards, there are no rules. And I'm also starting to see it in the culture. We're not talking about how we are leading organizations with design. We're not talking about the value that design is. We're starting to get into, and it concerns me that we're starting to have culture arguments more than actual business arguments. And so we're talking about things that don't really move the profession forward. And I would say that whenever we start talking about squishy things, and this is going to be probably controversial, but when we start getting into social issues as a profession, it concerns me because it makes it very easy for people who maybe disagree with us politically to just dismiss us altogether.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that we you know that people should not have opinions. What I'm saying is a profession should not be labeled as liberal or conservative or anything of that sort.
Right.
We are not here to have that discussion. We're here to advance our organizations with UX and design.
Yep.
And so, and the thing is, whenever we start having those discussions about society and culture, we stop talking about the profession. We stop talking about the craft. We stop talking about the value. And when that happens, expertise goes out the window.
Yep.
And then that just opens the door for unqualified charlatans to come in, you know, and I'm not going to name any names, but you can find them who are big voices, who have never done anything, you know, who who have no qualification.
Yeah.
I said I was going to maybe say some things. I may have just done it. I would recommend a book I recently finished. I've read it once or twice. I believe it's called The End of the Death of Expertise by Tom Nichols.
Oh my goodness.
Have you read it?
No, I think I heard about it. Yeah.
Yeah. I strongly, strongly recommend it. And he really talks about it. There's a lot of blame to go around, by the way. It's in, you know, in the workplace, it's in higher education. There's a lot of blame to go around that's really contributing to the end of expertise in our society.
Yeah.
And the knock-on effects are just, you know, they're never ending, unfortunately.
When you say that, you remind me of some of the, you've probably seen me get into some of these discussions with people where when we talk about standard and we talk about quality and we talk about building acumen and being excellent at your craft and having pride about that and being ethical about it, and then people will follow it up by saying, well, you're a gatekeeper. And the first time that ever happened to me, someone said, do you know what a gatekeeper is? And I'm going, that's the first time I ever heard the term used in this way. And I said, I'm thinking, do I know what a gatekeeper is? And the person who asked me the question, they were just upset that I was talking about information architecture. And I was talking about the importance of that to the discipline. And I was talking about all the different types of UX research that we can do, all these things that we can do to help drive value, advocating for the users and things of that nature. And the person's response to me was not, where can I learn these things and what are the options? The person was, do you know what a gatekeeper is? That was their response. And so I start digging into it a little bit to the extent there's an upcoming show where I'm going to break down and share all my research about gatekeeping, because what I found, two critical things. One is that gatekeeping is not what these people say. Nobody's trying to keep anybody out of the discipline. We're trying to help people to enter in the right way. We're trying to help you come through the front door and stop climbing in the back window. that's what we're trying to do. We're not trying to stop anybody. We're trying to empower people. And then we get called gatekeepers, and it's really quality advocacy.
It's back to, is this a profession or is it not? Is this a profession of consequence or not?
Bingo.
And if it is, then yes, we have to have quality standards. And, you know, if they want to call it a gatekeeper, fine, call it a gatekeeper. I call it making sure that, we're actually doing something, that we actually have a profession. By the way, you know, this also gets back to that idea of certification and licensure. Yeah. One of the reasons that industries have certification and licensure is to protect buyers.
Yes.
Right. So that companies know they're hiring somebody of quality. There are a lot of people. This is probably not the best example. There are a lot of people. And by the way, it can't just be at the schools. It can't just be done at boot camps and workshops and such. It has to be accredited by a third party.
Yep.
Because you know what? Here's the thing. There are a lot of people who go to law school, get a law degree, and can't pass the bar exam. And I think that's kind of what I'm looking at. Like, we need to have some kind of way to say, okay, it's great that you got a degree, but you can't actually do the work.
Yes.
And it also, and by the way, it holds higher education to account, and all education to account.
Absolutely. I've had students, and this is, some people wouldn't like me saying this, but I know that you've had the same experience I'm about to mention, that I've had students that you could not pay me, using that figure of speech, you couldn't pay me to work with. I knew that there was no passion. I knew that there was no real desire. I mean, it's happening today. I hear 300,000 people graduate from the Google program. And then I hear these stories, like tons of stories about the experiences within the programs, especially the one I'm going to call out here in particular, where somebody will turn in a blank document with a note smack dab in the middle of it saying, I didn't do the work. I just want to get the certificate. Will you please give me a passing grade? So now we've got this oversaturation for entry level UXers. That's even where it's been made muddier, because you got this another whole slew of people. They just want something. I said on LinkedIn yesterday, there are people, they want the UX job, but they don't want to do the UX work. And that hurts all of us, because at the very top of this is a C-suite person, some kind of decision maker, who's deciding whether or not to fund the UX department at a given organization or not. And they come in contact with these people, and then their lack of interest, their lack of ethics, then gets basically imputed onto all of us. And that's why I'm so loud, because I want people to, let's do this thing right. Again, not trying to keep you out. And I found out that definition of gatekeeping that they're using when they're referring to people like us that are talking like that, it's actually the urban definition of gatekeeping. It's not the actual, say, the Merriam-Webster's definition of gatekeeping or the professional definition. It's an urban, it's a slang definition, which I get it, but nobody's trying to do that. Then the funny thing is, we get accused of being gatekeepers, but who's really being kept out? Is it the, because there's always going to be less entry-level jobs. That's just the way it goes. Seniors have trouble getting jobs. Seniors, people who are longtime vets in UX, are not getting these director and manager jobs and principal jobs. They're going to people I come across people all the time. Yeah, I've been a lead UXer on a project, and you look at their work very closely. They don't demonstrate anything that has to do with none of the characteristics of a lead UXer. Their portfolio doesn't say anything, and I hate to talk about portfolios, but I'll get on that another time. They'll say that they have 10 years of experience, 15 years of experience, and you look closely, and they have like one or two. And I've even met people with one or two who will say that they're lead. I mean, how are you lead? You just started working there, and it's like mom and pa's peanut factory. It's not, you know, anything that's enterprise oriented, and it's just amazing to me. But there's issues, and it has to be addressed. I hope we arrive at some type of a certification a path at some point in time. Tough. Tough going.
Well, and I was just looking it up. Yeah, that book, it is The Death of Expertise by Tom Nichols.
I'm going to buy it.
Fantastic
book. I'm going to buy it when we're done.
You have to read it or listen to it. It is on Audible as well. Fantastic book, and I think really critical for our profession. Again, it's kind of like we need certification and gatekeeping. You know what? Here's the thing. It's kind of like if you go to a dentist. Right. I mean, yes. Yeah. Okay. They went to school. They passed. They still have to get board certified.
Yep.
But by the way, I don't want to go to a dentist that wasn't board certified. You know, the gatekeeper is supposed.
Yes.
You don't want those people putting their instruments in your mouth. Yeah. So if they can't be qualified, so
yep.
So it is important. Portfolios. I mean, since you mentioned it, I'll let's go down that rabbit hole. I love the sound effects, but portfolios. It is. I have many thoughts about portfolios. One of the challenges I think with portfolios, especially for a UX practitioner, is. I think the first thing you have to ask yourself is who is looking at this portfolio?
Bingo. Yes.
I interviewed for a job several years ago, a couple years ago. I don't even remember exactly what it was, but it was not a great interview process, but basically at the end of it, they're like, okay, well, can you send in your portfolio? I'm like, what do you mean send in my portfolio? What wouldn't we like talk about the portfolio?
Yes.
And talk about the process. The hiring manager is really busy. Just send it in. I'm like, okay, who's the hiring manager again? What's their role? Oh, he's the head engineer.
Oh boy.
I'm like, wait a minute. You're going to have the head engineer review the portfolio for a UX position. Yep. By the way, first UX position you've ever had for your company. This is not good. This is a beauty contest.
Yep.
And I said, you know, thanks, but no thanks. Because quite honestly, most of UX, and this is why I tell people, most of UX, most of user experience is not even visual. So exactly. Why are we talking about visual portfolios?
Exactly.
Why are we doing this? I mean, are we just checking the box? Are we just doing what we're familiar with? And I think that's largely the case. So yeah, portfolios, I mean, I think they're challenging. Never, ever, ever send in your portfolio if you can't talk about it. And by the way, make sure you know who's evaluating it. Chances are they're less qualified than an entry-level UX practitioner. So why would you let them, why would you let them evaluate your work? So I just said something else.
You remind me of a conversation I had with some people recently where there was a lot of entry level UX people in this conversation, and we were just having a discussion about some general things, but some kind of way portfolios came up, and it kept bringing up the issue of portfolios and referring to it as currency, and how I want to be able to get that interview, so my portfolio has got to be. I said, resumes. You get interviews with resumes. You want to present your portfolio, and then you want to talk about it, as you just said. But I said, there's a lot of people have no idea how to review a UX portfolio, on top of the fact that portfolios came into play with UX, what I've seen, because people always confuse us with the visual world, and they have portfolios, so why don't we get a portfolio from this UX person? And then they look at it with the same state of mind, and then judging it the same way. But I said, but a proper UX portfolio has an, I use the term ugly. It has a lot of ugly stuff in it. It's beneath the presentation layer. And which usually when you show that to people that are outside of our discipline, they want to see the aesthetics. They want to see the finished product. They don't want to see the sitemaps and wireframes and all this other kind of stuff that you did. So how are you going to show them something and you don't get to talk about the process and tell the story behind it? It's just amazing. But and that the show we're going to do is called The Problem with Portfolios. Yes. To yes. break these things well, down.
Yeah. Well, and incidentally, I mean, it's one of the reasons why whenever I was on full-time faculty at Kent State, there was always a capstone project or a capstone mm-hmm. experience. And I'm not exactly sure what it is now, but at the time, graduate students were given the option to do a portfolio or to do a project.
Yep.
I always, almost always encourage students to do a project. because I think it's important to do a really meaty project where you manage the research, you do the problem definition, you do the design recommendations and solution development, solution design. It's well encapsulated and it's also ownable. Nobody else is going to have the same final project that you will have.
Yeah.
And in fact, even to this day, I still refer to my my project in my work because it was a meaty, very significant piece of research.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm a little bit biased, but I think it's pretty good. But portfolios, I mean, it's useful at least for communicating what you've done. But if all you're going to show are really pretty wireframes, that's not interesting because right. you're just competing with graphic designers. I mean, that said, do I have a PDF of my work? Yes, I do. And it's mostly pictures of whiteboard sketches, journey maps. It's ugly because
yeah.
UX is more about the process and it's more about understanding people than it is about that final screen that you see, right? It's not like we just take out the good UX sauce and just pour it on and then go. You know, one of the examples, and I said this before, you know, most of UX is not visual. One of the examples I give to people very frequently is, and it to demonstrate this, is ATMs, right? So one of the big problems with ATMs, we've had them for what, 40 or 50 years. Big problem with ATMs, people forget their ATM cards, right? So they leave their ATM cards in there. And as a result, they don't have their ATM card. It's a, you know, creates security risk, et cetera, et cetera. You get a call from the bank and they say, you left your bank card here, come get it. But, you know, how do we actually address that? Well, an engineer, hypothetically, in my scenario that I'm going with, would say, well, what we ought to do is make the ATM beep really loudly to remind people to take their ATM card before they leave. Okay, well, for 40 years, ATMs have done that, and it hasn't worked. People still left their ATM cards in the machine.
Yeah.
A visual designer might say, oh, we need a better notification on the screen. Maybe we change the color. Maybe we make the buttons, maybe make the text bigger, right? And again, we've had those, and people still leave their ATM cards in ATM machines. Mm-hmm. You know what actually, what actually stops it? And I encountered this a couple years ago and it just blew my mind.
Yeah. I know where you're going. I think,
you know where I'm going with this. It wasn't visual. It was not audio. What they did is they changed the process. They changed yep. the actual interaction because
yep.
they said, we need to get inside the customer's head. Why are people leaving their ATM cards in the machine? Because they're not thinking about their ATM cards. They're thinking about if they're doing a cash withdrawal, they're thinking about getting their sweaty little hands on that cash. They get the cash and then they run away.
Yeah.
And then the ATM card comes out. And I saw this at an ATM. They changed up the process. So the card comes out first.
Yep.
And you can't get the cash till you get the card.
Yep.
That's not visual. That's not, you can't see that in a portfolio. You can't see that in a visual portfolio.
All cognition.
Yes. It's all about understanding people. And I think that's, you know, we're kind of at this inflection point with UX where, awesome. Yeah, there are more there's so much demand, but again, it's misplaced oftentimes. And, and I think a lot of it has to do with, we don't really have a good vocabulary and a good way of telling that story that's about understanding people and how they interact with technology and tools. And that's really what I'm all about, is how do we actually make technology and make the tools that are supposed to make our lives better? Mm-hmm. How do we do that? And it's not through making it prettier, it's to making it work better for people based on how people think and behave.
Yeah, you made me think about it. I'm teaching at another university now, mm-hmm. Where I get to design my courses. And what a novel idea. I have somebody's going to get angry at me for this, but you know, what else is new? I have 5 instructional design certifications and I finally get to design courses. What a novel idea. So, but I love taking students through mental model exercises, task analysis exercises,
yes,
and building mental models. If we're going to be user-centered, let's be user-centered. Because if what we produce is not user-centered, everybody suffers. The discipline suffers, you suffer, your team suffers, everybody, the users suffer. So it just makes me think about that. We got to get inside the head of the user. That's where we live. I always quote a line from a movie, right. One of my favorite movies, because a mix of classic sci-fi and martial arts, the movie Equilibrium with Christian Bale. And they're like the emotion police, because they feel that emotions are the problem of society. It all stems back from emotions. And so they give out this medication that suppresses emotions. And so if they can feel, if someone is feeling, as they call it, if they're starting to become emotionally driven, the police will come and get you. The tetragrammaton will come and get you. And they have a line in the movie that says, "It's my job to know what you're thinking." And when I saw that movie, I forgot I was looking at a movie and I went into UX mode, because to me, that's where true UX lives. It's our job to be inside the head of the users, to anticipate, to understand, and then to produce things that help to operate in line with where everybody is thinking and how they're working. And when we do that, everybody wins.
And when we say to help users, by the way, this is another one of the big themes from my career and that I talk about. We aren't doing this because, well, I mean, we might be nice people, but we're not doing this because we're nice people and we're just, you know, we just want to make things nice. We do this because it is a competitive tool for business outcomes.
Yep.
That's why we do UX, because we are working towards results. And so that's why, I mean, again, it's why I think the profession is so critical.
Yes, absolutely. Especially on the medical side, as I shift to another, what might end up being our closing question here, talking with one of our former guests, Dr. Giles, over in the UK, who is starting up a UX practice, and the aspect of his work is referred to as clinical UX, just looking at UX in the medical arena. I mean, yeah. Where everything you do, it becomes life and death, literally. I mean, I try to inspire people to understand the gravity of the discipline. And so different parts of UX, the automotive world, the OEM world, and there's the folks who are actually doing the building of things. And then you've got the IVR folks. And you mentioned before we started recording today, we talked about UX and financial services. Feel free to take it away and just what's on your mind with regard to UX and financial services?
Well, I mean, I think that UX has a really big role to play in financial services. I mean, I was listening to one of your earlier podcasts where you were talking about design challenges as part of a hiring process. And I did one recently, and I think that this was a good one. Now, I've done design challenges where it's kind of like, well, design our homepage. It's like, well, pay me. but I think that whenever you ask a UX practitioner to go through a design challenge as part of the hiring process, if you can ask them to do something in an adjacent field, and the intent is to see how they think and how they work, that yeah. makes sense.
Yes.
But asking them to produce some kind of work product that is directly applicable is not good.
Grossly unethical.
Financial services. Yeah, well, not good equals unethical. Yes. So But I mean, I think that UX really has to do a lot and does have a big role in financial literacy. We have some real problems in the United States. Student loans, student loan debt is just crushing a lot of people. You know, I'm an advocate. It's funny. I mean, when I was in business school, one of the things I looked at was, should we have some kind of a nutritional facts label for degrees? You know, like, okay, that's fine. You can get that degree in English, but do you know, and you're going to go to a prestigious school for it, but do you know what you're actually going to make with that degree? And the answer is probably not a lot. Generally, I think that we need to do a better job of educating people of the cost of their decisions, especially in higher education, especially in when we talk about student loans. And so I think that if we can kind of help people to understand what are the long-term outcomes of this decision. The other is retirement. Mm-hmm. Americans largely self-fund their retirement, or they're relying on Social Security, might be challenged in a couple of decades or less. But but we'll see. but I think we need to do a much better job of helping people to understand how much should they be putting away for retirement, and how do we actually project how much money you're going to have in retirement. And those are just two areas. I mean, there are so many things. Healthcare is funny. We're talking about financial services, but so much of healthcare ultimately in the United States comes down to money. We spend more money on healthcare per capita than any other nation in the world. And I'm not sure that we're getting better outcomes for it. In fact, I would reckon that we certainly are not. So what are the actual costs of healthcare? This is actually another project that we worked on when I was in business school, was how can we improve outcomes through financial instruments in the healthcare industry? And one of the things we looked at was we realized that, I can't remember exactly what the percentage is, but it's a very large percentage. Most of the healthcare dollars spent in the United States are spent in the last, I'm going to say, 6 months of life. And unfortunately, it's because people spend so much to avoid dying that they'll spend almost anything at the end of their lives. But they don't necessarily take the steps early on, you know, eating healthy, exercise, et cetera. And so are there financial instruments that we could design that would encourage better outcomes in the health space? And I think there are. And I think there's financial services companies that are probably best positioned to do that, or forward-looking healthcare providers that are out there.
Yep, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. So this has been dynamite. We're already a good hour in here, so we're going to wrap up here. Last question, very last question. What advice do you have for up and comers in the discipline of UX?
I think I'll expand on it. I'll say a couple of things. I mean, I guess what I would say is, don't let bad situations linger. Mm-hmm. If you are in a bad job, don't be too patient. Right? If you're in a toxic environment, leave.
Yeah.
Just leave. Just go to another job. It's not worth it to suffer through your days if you were in a bad environment. Likewise, mm-hmm. if you end up in a position where you have people on your team and maybe they're just a bad egg or a poor performer, or maybe they just have a bad attitude, let them go. And I'm the kind of person, when I make a decision, the distance between decision and action is pretty short. So whenever you have a problem, take care of the problem.
Yes.
When you have a problem and you've identified it, fix it. It doesn't make sense to just let things linger. Smile, be nice. It's important to make sure that you're having fun and that you're enjoying what you're doing. Be curious. I have students and people whose portfolios I've reviewed over the years who always ask me, what's the number one thing that I can do to be a good UX professional? And I would say, be curious, be ask why do things, why are things the way they are? And why do people do things that they do? And despite all the challenges, I mean, we've talked about a lot of challenges and a lot of things that need to be adjusted and fixed in UX. I'm still very bullish on the utility and the need for UX in our world. Mm-hmm. You know, again, because, you know, the fact is, people who use our systems are irrational. People who design systems are also irrational. And so we need to have people who are UX practitioners who come in and reduce that friction between people and their tools. Yes. You know, I'll give you an example just from a couple of weeks ago. We had a family member who had a COVID scare,
right?
Woke up Sunday morning, you know, didn't sleep at all, just felt terrible. And he wanted to get a COVID test. And I'm not even going to talk about how hard it is to get a COVID test, but went online and scheduled a test with a large national pharmacy. Mm-hmm. In his town, went to the pharmacy at his assigned time, 4:00 in the afternoon on a Sunday, got there, and pharmacy was closed. So they weren't doing any tests. I'm like, well, then why did you let him book the appointment?
Right, right.
Like, this is a major problem. And I'm sure he's not the only person this has happened to. And so, mm-hmm. you know, and now some people might say, well, that's QA. And yes, to a certain degree it is. But we also, as UX practitioners, need to kind of help our companies and help our organizations to foresee and forecast those sorts of problems and avoid that sort of thing. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm very bullish about the future for UX. I'm glad I'm doing it. I can't think of another profession I would want to do at this point. You know, there are challenges, but there's a lot of opportunities and there's a lot of need. And what we really need are people who are passionate about it, who are curious about it, mm-hmm. and who really care about, we need people who care about doing good work more than yes. they care about getting money.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So
that is it. Well, that's the end of the list. Phenomenal discussion. I absolutely love this. I went into student mode here a lot and just let you go. And I didn't say a lot at certain segments. I'm just taking it in. And I know people are going to really, really appreciate this. And again, it's important. I repeat what I said earlier. It's really important for people to hear voices. There's a lot of voices in the UX world today. It's too bad that more people don't have filters because I call it baby bird syndrome. They're eyes wide shut and mouth wide open, as I like to describe it, like a baby bird is being fed by mama bird and trusting that mama bird is going to drop something good in there. But there's a lot of people dropping things in there and it's not a good thing. I try to help, and what I do in this podcast, help people to develop those filters. And I want to bring people on the show that are voices that you need to hear and that voices that I'm hoping you listen to it again and again, because there's some phenomenal takeaways here and things that folks can use to build themselves up. So thank you for joining me today, D. Ben Woods.
Thank you, Darren.
Thank you for helping to share your voice and your sentiments for the UX community at large. And we're going to wrap up here, folks. So thank you, those of you, for listening in on today. Thanks for joining us. Share the podcast with your friends out there. Get the word out, and we will see you again next week. So it's time to sign off here, folks. This is Darren Hood, the host of The World of UX. Happy UXing, everybody.
Thanks for joining us for this session of CX of M Radio. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, and visit cxofm.org for more resources.
RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.